Demons, Fyodor Dostoevsky. Part 1. Chapter 1. Introductory. Some details of the biography of that highly respected gentleman, Stepan Trofimovich Verkhovensky. In undertaking to describe the recent and strange incidents in our town, till lately wrapped in uneventful obscurity, I find myself forced, in absence of literary skill, to begin my story rather far back, that is to say, with certain biographical details concerning that talented and highly esteemed gentleman, Stepan Trofimovich Verkhovensky. I trust that these details may at least serve as an introduction, while my projected story itself will come later. I will say at once that Stepan Trofimovich has always filled a particular role among us, that of the progressive patriot, so to say, and he was passionately fond of playing that part. So much so that I really believe he could not have existed without it. Not that I would put him on a level with an actor at a theatre, God forbid, for I really have a respect for him. This may all have been the effect of habit, or rather, more exactly, of a generous propensity he had from his earliest years for indulging in an agreeable daydream in which he figured as a picturesque public character. He fondly loved, for instance, his position as a persecuted man and, so to speak, an exile. There is a sort of traditional glamour about those two little words that fascinated him once for all, and, exalting him gradually in his own opinion, raised him in the course of years to a lofty pedestal very gratifying to vanity. In an English satire of the last century, Gulliver, returning from the land of the Lilliputians, where the people were only 3 or 4 inches high, had grown so accustomed to consider himself a giant among them that, as he walked along the streets of London, he could not help crying out to carriages and passers-by to be careful and get out of his way for fear he should crush them, imagining that they were little, and he was still a giant. He was laughed at and abused for it, and rough coachmen even lashed at the giant with their whips. But was that just? What may not be done by habit? Habit had brought Stepan Trofimovich almost to the same position, but in a more innocent and inoffensive form, if one may use such expressions, for he was a most excellent man. I am even inclined to suppose that, towards the end, he had been entirely forgotten everywhere. But still, it cannot be said that his name had never been known. It is beyond question that he had at one time belonged to a certain distinguished constellation of celebrated leaders of the last generation, and at one time, though only for the briefest moment, his name was pronounced by many hasty persons of that day, almost as though it were on a level with the names of Chardaev, of Bielinski, of Granovsky, and of Gyertsen, who had only just begun to write abroad. But Stepan Trofimovich's activity ceased almost at the moment it began, owing, so to say, to a vortex of combined circumstances. And, would you believe it, it turned out afterwards that there had been no vortex and even no circumstances, at least in that connection. I only learned the other day, to my intense amazement, though on the most unimpeachable authority, that Stepan Trofimovich had lived among us in our province not as an exile, as we were accustomed to believe, and had never even been under police supervision at all. Such is the force of imagination. All his life he sincerely believed that in certain spheres he was a constant cause of apprehension, that every step he took was watched and noted, and that each one of the 3 governors who succeeded one another during 20 years in our province came with special and uneasy ideas concerning him, which had, by higher powers, been impressed upon each before everything else, on receiving the appointment. Had anyone assured the honest man on the most irrefutable grounds that he had nothing to be afraid of, he would certainly have been offended. Yet Stepan Trofimovitch was a most intelligent and gifted man, even, so to say, a man of science, though indeed in science, well, in fact, he had not done such great things in science. I believe indeed he had done nothing at all, but that's very often the case, of course, with men of science among us in Russia. He came back from abroad and was brilliant in the capacity of lecturer at the university towards the end of the '40s. He only had time to deliver a few lectures. I believe they were about the Arabs. He maintained, too, a brilliant thesis on the political and Hanseatic importance of the German town Hanau, of which there was promise in the epoch between 1413 and 1428, and on the special and obscure reasons why that promise was never fulfilled. This dissertation was a cruel and skilful thrust at the Slavophils of the day, and at once made him numerous and irreconcilable enemies among them. Later on, after he had lost his post as lecturer, however, he published, by way of revenge, so to say, and to show them what a man they had lost, in a progressive monthly review, which translated Dickens and advocated the views of George Sand, the beginning of a very profound investigation into the causes, I believe, of the extraordinary moral nobility of certain knights at a certain epoch, or something of that nature. Some lofty and exceptionally noble idea was maintained in it anyway. It was said afterwards that the continuation was hurriedly forbidden, and even that the Progressive Review had to suffer for having printed the first part. That may very well have been so, for what was not possible in those days? Though in this case it is more likely that there was nothing of the kind, and that the author himself was too lazy to conclude the essay. He cut short his lectures on the Arabs because, somehow and by someone, probably one of his reactionary enemies, a letter had been seized giving an account of certain circumstances, in consequence of which someone had demanded an explanation from him. I don't know whether the story is true, but it was asserted that at the same time there was discovered in Petersburg a vast, unnatural, and illegal conspiracy of 30 people, which almost shook society to its foundations. It was said that they were positively on the point of translating Fourier. As though of design, a poem of Stepan Trofimovitch's was seized in Moscow at that very time, though it had been written 6 years before in Berlin in his earliest youth, and manuscript copies had been passed round a circle consisting of 2 poetical amateurs and 1 student. This poem is lying now on my table. No longer ago than last year I received a recent copy in his own handwriting from Stepan Trofimovitch himself, signed by him, and bound in a splendid red leather binding. It is not without poetical merit, however, and even a certain talent. It's strange, but in those days, or to be more exact, in the '30s, people were constantly composing in that style. I find it difficult to describe the subject, for I really do not understand it. It is some sort of an allegory in lyrical dramatic form, recalling the second part of Faust. The scene opens with a chorus of women, followed by a chorus of men, then a chorus of incorporeal powers of some sort, and at the end of all, a chorus of spirits not yet living but very eager to come to life. All these choruses sing about something very indefinite, for the most part about somebody's curse, but with a tinge of the higher humour. But the scene is suddenly changed. There begins a sort of festival of life, at which even insects sing. A tortoise comes on the scene with certain sacramental Latin words, and even, if I remember aright, a mineral sings about something that is a quite inanimate object. In fact, they all sing continually, or if they converse, it is simply to abuse one another vaguely, but again with a tinge of higher meaning. At last, the scene is changed again. A wilderness appears, and among the rocks there wanders a civilized young man who picks and sucks certain herbs. Asked by a fairy why he sucks these herbs, he answers that, conscious of a superfluity of life in himself, he seeks forgetfulness, and finds it in the juice of these herbs, but that his great desire is to lose his reason at once, a desire possibly superfluous. Then a youth of indescribable beauty rides in on a black steed, and an immense multitude of all nations follow him. The youth represents death, for whom all the peoples are yearning. And finally, in the last scene, we are suddenly shown the Tower of Babel, and certain athletes at last finish building it with a song of new hope. And when at length they complete the topmost pinnacle, the Lord, of Olympia, let us say, takes flight in a comic fashion, and man, grasping the situation and seizing his place, at once begins a new life, with new insight into things. Well, this poem was thought at that time to be dangerous. Last year I proposed to Stepan Trofimovitch to publish it, on the ground of its perfect harmlessness nowadays, but he declined the suggestion with evident dissatisfaction. My view of its complete harmlessness evidently displeased him, and I even ascribed to it a certain coldness on his part, which lasted 2 whole months. And what do you think? Suddenly, almost at the time I proposed printing it, here our poem was published abroad in a collection of revolutionary verse, without the knowledge of Stepan Trofimovitch. He was at first alarmed, rushed to the governor, and wrote a noble letter in self-defence to Petersburg. He read it to me twice, but did not send it, not knowing to whom to address it. In fact, he was in a state of agitation for a whole month, but I am convinced that in the secret recesses of his heart he was enormously flattered. He almost took the copy of the collection to bed with him, and kept it hidden under his mattress in the daytime. He positively would not allow the women to turn his bed, and although he expected every day a telegram, he held his head high. No telegram came. Then he made friends with me again, which is a proof of the extreme kindness of his gentle and unresentful heart.